Sonia, the Macba as it happens.
Ari Benjamin Myers is a Berlin-based composer, orchestra director, and artist. He has recently composed the soundtrack for the film 1,395 Days Without Red by Sheila Kamrich and Anri Sala. Far from being a one-off oddity, his involvement in this project is a clear sign of his transversal approach to creation, in which collaboration as a modus operandi is paramount. In spite of his classical training, Ari participates in diverse initiatives such as a post-hardcore band called Salam and joint projects with musicians like Thomas Fellman and Enstruzende Neubauten, which are often more conceptual than musical in the traditional sense. Sunea talks to Ari Benjamin Myers about 1,395 Days Without Red and some aspects of his work in general. The process of 1,395 Days Without Red.
In a film like this, the absence of music becomes something very special and very meaningful, you know, because it's a film that where there is so much music and it's based on music. So of course, when you don't have music, it's very strong. And I think, you know, again, it's a musical idea, but it also has a parallel in something very real, which is that this orchestra that we worked with, this, the National Symphony of Sarajevo, you know, this was the orchestra that was playing every day during the siege, you know, and lost, you know, many musicians and were playing every day, and people were coming by to hear them play. So in a very real way, you know, you can imagine them playing every day to kind of keep their spirits up, keep their humanity going. And you could imagine that if there was a day when you would show up and the place was closed and there was no orchestra, no music, what that would mean. We filmed it, all the music, the rehearsals, and the work with the orchestra were from the TV building, this building that was built when they hosted the Olympics. So of course it's, you know, very symbolic in a way, but it's also a real crazy building, a kind of Kafkaesque labyrinth, you know, also very sort of communist style in a certain way. I mean, and it's the type of building that you would go up a staircase and open a door, and it would be just nothing like the outside, or, you know, you could like fall, you know, like this, or you'd go into another room somewhere and it'd be a huge room that had, you know, 40 television cameras all covered in plastic, and, you know, like it was a very bizarre building. But this is also where they rehearsed, because it was a very fortified building. It was kind of a bunker almost, you know. So of course playing there and rehearsing there and working there really, it of course shaped the atmosphere of the music, and, you know, it just felt like a very sick building. You know, the air was bad, and, you know, it was full of asbestos probably, and it just seemed very unhealthy to be there in that building, and I'm sure that had a huge impact on the quality of the music, the sound of the music.
Revisiting the Sarajevo siege.
During the siege, I mean, this is what, and I talked to the musicians about it. I mean, it's an amazing orchestra that, you know, went through something like that. They would meet, sometimes not be, they wouldn't be necessarily complete, you know, but they would meet every day, whoever could make it and made it, and they would play. They weren't really rehearsing for anything because there were no concerts or no performances, but they would just, music making is a very, you know, I think it's something that people go to when everything else is maybe lost, or seems like it's lost. You know, music is it's a very sort of reaffirming thing, you know, in the sense that if you're making music, then there's some kind of humanity left. I mean, of course, very famous examples in the concentration camps and things like this, you know. And they played every day in this building, and people could come, and it was really just like a free concert, you know. I think they were really just playing, going through what they had. You know, I think a lot of the, you know, Beethoven symphonies, I'm sure it might have also been Tchaikovsky. I mean, I think they were just, you know, it was more like playing for the sake of playing and just going through the music that they had or the repertoire they had. I live in Berlin, and I came to Germany actually as a conductor, as an opera conductor. So again, very classical, very, you know, I love opera, you know. But I have to say, especially the conducting is now something that I do really in the, mostly in the context of projects, or in some cases, like I do, you know, I'll conduct new music, basically. So the conducting isn't, in a sense, it's not something that I'm doing now in a kind of traditional way, like I'm not really working as a conductor who goes and conducts. So the conducting is really something that's very much part of the whole compositional process, or even a kind of performative thing. I have a piece that I did in a gallery in Berlin, Werner Klaas in Vienna. It's called The Lightning and Its Flash, and it's a composition that I wrote for solo conductor. So it's a composition for one conductor, and I performed it. It's 40 minutes long, it's quite long, it's very intense, it's very physically demanding, but it takes place in total silence, and it really makes the conductor into a kind of, in that sense, a dancer, I mean, really, which is what you are.
From the opera hall to the White Cube.
Right now, I do feel more at home somehow in the art context. It's first of all a great freedom that as soon as you enter the music realm, you know, you have these, you know, very, very typical, I would even call them tropes, you know, you make a piece of music, so when is the CD going to come? And then you perform it in concert, and of course you want as many people as possible to come, and there's this weird phenomenon in contemporary music that even if it's a very experimental or theoretical or conceptual, or there's still, because it's under this umbrella or word or whatever, music, for instance, there's still this really bizarre idea that theoretically it should be embraced and loved by thousands and thousands and millions of people. That can't and shouldn't be true. I mean, if you're doing something very experimental in the sense of an experiment, then, you know, of course it's not going to appeal to everyone. And why should it? And I think, for instance, you know, for most, maybe not all, but I think most artists, you know, are very free of this idea that that the whole world should love their art, you know. But as a musician, if you give a concert, you don't want that 5 people show up to your concert, you want that 10,000 people show up to your concert, you know, in a very populist kind of way. That's why right now it feels very natural to me to be working with artists and working in this kind of space where you don't, A doesn't always mean B, you know, because you write a composition, it doesn't mean that, you know, we have to record it and put it out. It means, well, how would you, you know, maybe there's a more interesting way, to, you know, or how do you present it, or do we give a concert, or maybe there's a more interesting way, or how should it be heard? Should it be heard? Maybe it's not meant to be heard. I don't want to sound like I'm complaining. I mean, it's a very exciting time, you know. And for me, for instance, you mentioned Salon. You know, that was like that whole thing was almost like a self-performance, you know, for me to be in this band and take everything on that it means to be in a band and put out this record and go on tour and really be playing in essentially a kind of hardcore band. You know, it was almost like a... At the time, it felt like one of the most extreme things I could do, and I think I'm very interested in kind of extreme, you know, taking things a bit to an extreme place. And what was funny about that was that I first had, you know, ideas for other things, like in the band Salon, the lead singer, Chris Spencer, he's a good friend. His other band is this kind of a legendary New York hardcore band, Unsane. And I always wanted to work with Chris, they're amazing. And I had an idea, and I've known Chris a long time, you know. I came at it in a kind of like, you know, a sort of artsy way, like I'll do something artsy with Chris. And then as soon as we started working together, I realized that this approach in a way was totally wrong, because I was kind of imposing, the, you know, I, kind of this typical, you know, I'm a new music guy, so I'll do something kind of artsy with it. And then I realized, no, the most extreme thing I could do would be to say, okay, let's make a band, like a real band. And in a way, I think the record was kind of a surprise.
Crossing the line to other genres.
There is this whole baggage of crossover and, you know, classic meets whatever, classic meets this and this meets that. And the whole notion of crossover, the word crossover is really, it's a marketing word that doesn't really even mean anything. But if it means something, it usually means something derogatory, something bad. You know, Pavarotti sings U2, something like this, you know. And I think, for a number of reasons, I think it's been a bit of the exception that there have been, like, you know, meaningful collaborations between different kinds of, and there's different reasons for that. I mean, one thing is that it's hard to be a good collaborator. It's like anything else. It's also a skill. I mean, this is something I've come to learn from doing a lot of collaborations, that it's also, it's not just something you do and say, okay, you and you collaborate, okay, fine. Collaborating is also something that can be learned, it can be taught, you have to be good at it, you have to have a partner who's good at it. You know, if I were allowed to say I'm a good collaborator, and if I'm working with a good collaborator, then we can make something really great. But that's, I think, one reason why it hasn't always been so successful, because I don't think there's been enough attention paid to just the art of collaborating. You have to spend a lot of time together. And then the financial pressures, because of course you also have to be, I mean, what you don't see usually on my, let's say, biography, or if you look on our website or whatever, you don't see all the projects that haven't come. In a way, you know, now that I'm talking to you, you know, in a way I should put them on, because I'm very proud of them, you know, and this goes back to the idea of experiment. You know, I have no problem with, if the experiment is good, but it fails, it's still a great experiment, you know. I have no problem with failing. I mean, I think failing is good if it's out of something, you know. I mean, if you talk to a scientist or a research person, you know, they might spend 10 or 20 years of their life on a kind of experiment, and in the end, it turns out that their hypothesis was wrong. But they still can tell you really very emotionally how beautiful the experiment was to get to that point.
Yeah, let's go on.
Maintaining the composer's identity.
I guess the range, you know, of what I've done is so different that I sometimes even wonder how many people really are following everything. I mean, every once in a while I do meet someone who says, I'm a great fan of your work, and then I'm always a bit surprised, because I always feel like, you know, that Salon has its fans, and the work with Neubauten has its fans, and then the work with, you know, the club, you know, but people from the club and electronic stuff, you know, I would think, are they, you know, would they ever go to a Salon concert? You know, but that's also a little bit the point. But I guess what I'm saying is it's a point that I think about, in the sense of that if I was a more typical composer, and I could say, well, here's my work, and here's 10 CDs of my work, you know, of course, then it's easier to say, ah, this is his sound. But if you're collaborating, and if you're doing extremely different things, and also enjoying working in the context, you know, in other words, you know, I think I get very into, you know, even though I, like I said, I stay myself still. If I'm working at the Semperoper Dresden, then I am getting caught up in that world of opera, and you know. And if I'm in a club, it's something very different. So it's both. I'm still me, but part of the work is putting myself fully into that thing.
Context over aesthetics.
I would say I'm very obsessed with situation. You know, I'm very obsessed with context. There's almost nothing I could think of musically that wouldn't in some way be interesting for me if the context is interesting. You know, I mean, if Justin Bieber, whatever, if the phone rang, you said, ah, this is Justin, I really want to, let's work on a song. You know, of course, this will never happen. But the situation would be so bizarre that right away, I know that this would be something, you know, I would love to do, you know, this would be super interesting, And it's a bit hard to understand, because then you say, but if it's musically not interesting, how is it? But, you know, for me, the situation trumps the aesthetic of a particular musical language, you know, which is why I think it's, I've done things like play in this hardcore band and go, you know, or do club nights, because the situation and the people and the audience and the crowd and what, and how, you know, to me are, that's for me the composition, you know. I guess at the end of the day, what I'm doing is sort of composing the audience, you know, composing their expectations and their, you know, through music, or maybe that's sort of my obsession, is understanding that, trying to work with that, trying to control that, and spending a lot of time thinking about it.
Makba.cat